Today on the show, I'm joined by George Camel, a Ramsey personality, author of the brand new book, Breaking Free from Broke, The Ultimate Guide to More Money and Less Stress. George, what a pleasure. Welcome to the show.
Joe, it's so good to be with you. And I got to tell you, it sounds so much cooler when you say the title of the book than when I do. I need you to follow me around as my announcer. It'd be fantastic.
I'm more than happy to be of use, sir. George, you've got a fascinating story yourself. I loved reading about your story in terms of kind of where you got to today. I wonder if you could just kind of share just a little bit with us just about your background and kind of what inspired you really to write this much needed, timely book.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I grew up as kind of the average millennial outside of Boston, Massachusetts, and my parents were immigrants from the Middle East, from Egypt and Syria. So I was a first generation American, my brother and I, and we kind of were navigating the money culture along with my parents, and they adapted to it very quickly. And so it was, you got to get the credit score so you can get the credit card, so you can get the car payment, so you can get the mortgage. And that turned into me falling for money traps as well. So I graduated with $36,000 in student loan debt, living on credit cards, got $4,000 in credit cards. And I found myself at 23 going, is this it? This can't be the American dream that we were all promised, that immigrants come to America for, just to have payments all over our life and unable to do the things that we want to do. And so I got introduced to Dave Ramsey's company and got started here as an intern, went through our flagship money course called Financial Peace University, and it changed everything. I went from this cynical, anxious, depressed, angry 23-year-old who thought it's everyone else's problem, screw them, the misguided guidance counselors, the well-meaning parents, society at large, they led me down this path. And Financial Peace University kind of gave me this, hey, it's not all your fault, but it's your responsibility. And it showed me that the system is designed to keep us broke. And so once I could kind of deprogram this money matrix, it helped me get out of that $40,000 in debt in 18 months. It helped me get an emergency fund so I never had to go back into debt again. It helped me start investing into retirement plans for the future and even pay off our house in our early 30s between my wife and I and go from a negative net worth to a millionaire in 10 years. And so now I'm screaming from the rooftops, if I can do it as the average George, you can too.
You mentioned $40,000 worth of debt. I did a little Google search and I said that the average American is $103,000 in debt, which sounds quite substantial, quite scary. What is, in your view, kind of behind this consumer debt crisis that we're seeing today?
Well, it's a lot of good intentions and it's a lot of bad money habits. And I truly don't think it's all of our fault. I think our parents pressure us into a certain life and a certain further education. And they go, hey, you got to go to college because it's the right path and you're going to make more money and you're going to make mom and dad proud, because nobody wants to brag to their friends that their kid is going to the community college or trade school down the road. And so we've trained society to look at our reputation as the main thing driving our financial decisions. And so that also bleeds into the kind of car we drive. Well, we can't drive that. We need a more safe and reliable vehicle. So we're going to go get a new one that's for $40,000 on a loan when we don't even have a good full-time job yet. And so that happens with student loans. And I talk about the student loan crisis in the book in America. It's tragic. Colleges just started raising tuition to unlimited levels because we would take out unlimited loans to pay for it. And so this was a money-making scheme for the colleges and the student loan companies. And so all of this over time, along with inflation and hard economic times and you name it, have led to us just making outlandish decisions that are going to affect us for the next 10, 20, 30 years, even generationally, if we don't get them under control.
One of the interesting things about debt that I've taken away from you and your work is that it seems like probably never before in history has debt been so glamorized. You know, people, for instance, like Robert Kiyosaki, I watched a video of him openly bragging about being $1 billion in debt. You know, his argument, of course, would be that, you know, this is, as he would call it, good debt. So I'm kind of just curious, you know, what your kind of views are perhaps on that and perhaps how, I guess, debt, the perceptions of debt seem to have changed, where perhaps it maybe it's even become popular in today's day and age.
Well, you know, in our grandparents' day and age, debt was shameful. You didn't want to owe people money because they understood that that took away your freedom. That changed relationships. That held you back from your future. And all of a sudden, with the internet and social media and a lot of young people wanting to build wealth way too quickly because they feel like there's no hope. I don't want to wait till I'm 65 like mom and dad to then find out I can't even retire. And so they're going, I need $1 million in the next year. And that causes people to take a lot of really scary, risky shortcuts. And it causes all the grifters and fraudsters and scammers to come out of the woodwork to tell you why their course, their path is going to be your ticket to wealth very quickly. So that's where all these investing traps have started bubbling up. And I think it's largely why people are so attracted to debt, because they see it now as a wealth building tool and they see it as normal. If you don't have a car payment, if you don't have a mortgage payment, you're the weird one. You're the crazy person in today's world. And so I'm okay being weird if it means that my greatest wealth building tool, my income, is at my disposal every single time that paycheck hits. It's not going right back out to lenders, which is the American story these days. And so we have a very controversial take that there is no such thing as good debt. The only good debt is the one that's paid off and out of your life.
Financial problems seem to come from our own psychology, our own comparisons with other people, our own feelings of inadequacy or discontentment. Does that sound right?
Oh, absolutely. I just spoke at a church, and one of the areas I told them is holding us back from freedom and wealth is a lack of contentment. And what we found is, you know, the evidence of our envy is our debt. And so anytime we have this comparison mode, we're trying to run someone else's race. Turns out there is no finish line when you're trying to run someone else's race. And so what that looks like is trying to keep up, trying to get that car because you can't drive the beater car when all your friends have the nice cars. And you can't have that house. You went to school for 4 or 6 years. You can't be in that kind of house. And so what it causes us to do is make financial decisions before we're actually ready for it, before we can pay cash. And so when you take debt off the table, what that means is I'm going to slow down and move at the speed of cash. And that level of patience and delayed gratification and silencing the impulsive inner toddler is actually what helps people build wealth and keep it long term.
And it's almost, a social risk these days to not be in debt. And there was a fantastic quote that you talked about in your book. And this was from C.S. Lewis. He said, when the whole world is running toward a cliff, he who is running in the opposite direction appears to have lost his mind. And when it comes to money, I find that so powerful that I imagine for the average person, if they do decide to make these changes, they suddenly say, you know what, I'm not going to go broke to buy this holiday or for this house or to keep up with the Joneses. I imagine that at the beginning, perhaps you'd be best known. Is there some resistance from peers typically? Is there usually met with some resistance from those closest?
Oh, absolutely. And depending on your friend group, you know, I'm in the bubble here at Ramsey. And so all of my friends, you know, we have the same values when it comes to money. But I understand for a lot of people, that's weird. And your friends, you know, you might lose relationships over this because money touches every single part of our life. And eventually you might need to run with a different crowd that is trying to better themselves when it comes to money, instead of just keep up this facade and prop up a lifestyle that's unsustainable. And so that's what we found over time is you got to be around the right people. You have to change your input. Sometimes that's social media, people in your life telling you the wrong things. And that's a difficult thing because you're dealing with relationships and money. And there's so much emotion tied to all of that.
I've listened to many an episode of The Ramsey Show. I always love hearing Jerry Rafferty, Baker Street at the beginning.
Oh, yes. And,
you know. How did you get that, by the way, as the opening to the podcast? How did you do that?
Oh, that was 30 years ago. Dave had heard that song, and he asked if they could use it. And so they actually licensed it just for that show. And so it's been a mainstay now, and I don't think we'll ever change it. People would be like rioting outside our doorstep if we decided to change it. It's become an epic, nostalgic kind of hook. Every time I hear it, if I'm like in a mall, I get freaked out. I'm like, oh no, I'm about to be live. Where's my mic? You know, I start to freak out. So it's funny how music can be so triggering emotionally in the best ways.
Well, as podcast introduction goes, I mean, you've got, you know, it's incredibly hard to beat that one. So I totally agree. In terms of just debt, so I've listened to so many interviews on The Ramsey Show, and going through your book. And it seems to me like debt can be a real, you know, obviously today we're going to talk about, you know, what to do about it and these other tactics. But at a base level, having it, having bad consumer debt, high interest payments, struggling, what to, you know, considering declaring bankruptcy and these other things. I listen to some of the people and there sounds like a lot of despair in their voice, panic, anxiety, frustration, depression. At a real, I guess at the base level, what have been some of the effects that you've seen of people like when they really have it bad? Because you obviously get a lot of extreme examples. What are the real kind of like bad cases where you see it is worse? Like these are the effects that it can have on people, marriages, friendships, households.
Absolutely. Well, we know that money fights and money problems are one of the leading causes of divorce. And so on one side, relationally, it can destroy your marriage. It can destroy, you know, even a girlfriend, fiance relationship. We've seen really sad situations where people get in, they intermingle finances before they're married, and all of a sudden it didn't work out. And your name is on that loan for your ex-fiance, and they can't get rid of the loan, and it's on them legally. And so those are scary situations. The other one is people delay their life. They go, hey, I can't get married. I can't have kids. I can't work the job I want to work. I can't live where I want to live because of the debt holding me back. That's a really sad one as well, especially student loans, because people can call in and they go, I got $200,000 in student loans. What am I going to do? A guy called in last week and he got a computer science degree and he was $270,000 in student loan debt and he's making $50,000 working in cybersecurity. And we were just like dumbfounded as to how you could spend that much on this degree and be making this much. And so the ROI wasn't there. And we had to tell this guy, you got to go double, triple your income if you want to pay this off in the next few years. Otherwise, this is going to be a life sentence. And then lastly, you see the really sad situations where people call in saying, I think I'm on the verge of bankruptcy. I can't get out of this fast enough. The interest keeps ballooning the balance and the payment, and I can't keep up. And they end up having to sell their home, move. Hopefully they have a support system that can help them. And I've even got DMs, Joe, that are really sad where people are going, hey, I'm thinking about taking my own life because of the debt that's surrounding me, and I don't feel like there's a way out. And so that's the most drastic, of course, but there's a gamut. And regardless of where you are in that, we've all had that pit in the stomach, lump in the throat feeling when it comes to money, when it's not enough and you're not sure if you'll ever get there. And it always leads to this hopelessness. So what we do on The Ramsey Show, we technically talk about money, but really what we're trying to do in 5 or 7 minutes is just give someone hope that they're able to take the right next step, to give them the confident education of here's exactly what you need to do. We're going to give you the tools to help you get there. That if I can do that in 5 minutes, I feel like that's a good day in my book.
From a practical perspective that you guys really hammered home to me is also that if you are spending your hard-earned money on paying off credit card debts, on car payments, that also takes away from your wealth building tools to invest, to do X or to do Y, to generate income, to put in retirement funds towards a house, etc. So from a practical perspective, it also makes sense not to be in debt because it robs your income, right?
Absolutely. And it's why we tell people do this one thing at a time. As people call into The Ramsey Show, the most common situation we walk into is they're doing a lot of good things. They're just trying to do it all at once and they're not making any progress. They're like, hey, I'm trying to pay off my debt, but I'm also investing in my retirement plan, but I'm also trying to save up the down payment and I'm trying to get the emergency fund built up, but I need to upgrade the car. And we're just like, whoa, whoa, slow down, slow your roll. And so what we tell them to do is follow the baby steps, which is get $1,000 saved. That's the only thing you're focused on. Make minimum payments on your debts. Once you have $1,000 in the bank, move on to baby step two. Pay off all the consumer debt except the house using the debt snowball method. That means smallest to largest balance, ignore the interest rate, because if we were doing math, we wouldn't be in debt. And so now's not the time to start calculating which path is the best. We want the fastest path to get out of debt, and that is the debt snowball method. Once you're out of consumer debt, you freed up all these payments in your life. So now you can easily save up that emergency fund in another 6 to 12 months. And now you have a force field between you and life that helps you never go back into debt again. Why do you need the credit card as an emergency blanket when you have $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 sitting there ready to protect you. And now and only then are you ready to invest. Because most people, as they call in Joe, they're going, hey, I'm investing 3%. I'm like, well, that's not enough to survive in retirement. You need to be investing 15%. And so that's what you can do in baby step four without any payments. And then once you're doing baby step four, you're saving for retirement 15%. You're putting some money away for college if you have kids. You're paying off the house early, knocking out that mortgage, knocking down the principal balance. Once you have all that knocked out, now we can build wealth and give. Now we can really amp up our investing. We can amp up our giving. We can spend more and increase our lifestyle. But the problem is people want to increase their lifestyle before they've done any of these steps. And there's an order to the chaos. And you've got to sacrifice for a short season to have a much longer season of peace and freedom.
Someone listening to this is in a bad position. So the first two steps they do, get £1,000 in my case, or $1,000 in your case, put that into an emergency savings account. Then using the debt snowball method, which is paying off in order of lowest balance to highest balance, going through that order. And I take it that is due, that you want some psychological momentum there. You want to get that small win. You want to get that hit the dopamine. You want to go, I've just got my first financial win in a long time. Now I can keep going.
Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of people want to argue because they want to do the avalanche method, which is pay the highest interest debts first, which sounds great on paper. The problem is most people can't follow through with that. And it's not even our opinion anymore because we've seen 10 million people now go through this plan with success. It's also studies from Time Magazine and Harvard. They're all saying, hey, that Dave Ramsey guy's right. The debt snowball method psychologically and in reality is the best way to pay off your debt. And it's the same method I use to get rid of my $40,000 in 18 months. And I believe it's possible for anyone out there. And obviously, the more debt you have and the less income you have, it might take longer. For some people, it doesn't take 2 years. It takes 5 years, 7 years. But on average, we found people can do this in 2 years or less with intensity, which means you're cutting the subscriptions, you're cutting down your lifestyle, you're not eating out all the time, you're maybe working a side hustle or an extra job. But for a short season, if you can just focus and do that, you're going to have so much freedom on the other side.
I love that, man. I love that. And let's say, you know, just hypothetically at an extreme end, that someone calls in and they say, I've got $1,000 for the month. And if I pay back, you know, and I've got to eat, I've got to pay my mortgage, I've got to pay my creditors, I've got to feed the kids. How do you talk about like prioritizing them? How do you talk about prioritizing those payments?
That's a really great question. We talk about this idea of the four walls, and that means food, utilities, shelter, transportation. If you can cover those, you can fight another day. Forget about the creditors right now. It's more important to feed the family and keep the lights on and get the rent paid. And so that's the number one priority in your life, to cover that. Once you have those covered, make sure that you have your insurance bills paid, because insurance is going to protect you from the big, scary risks of life. And that's auto insurance and homeowners insurance, renters insurance, health insurance, term life insurance. If you have people that rely on your income, that's super important. And beyond that, then we can focus on paying our debts in order of smallest to largest. And if that means making minimum payments on debts, fine. If that means you got to get current on your debts and keep them there, great. But, you know, I'd rather you call the creditor and say, hey, listen, I can't pay you this month. But be proactive about it because they can really screw up your life. But don't let them bully you when you're trying to take care of your family and cover your debts. And I'm telling you, if you can follow those baby steps and you get that second job and you cut down your lifestyle, most people, unless they're in a really dire situation, they can overcome that with a little bit of time and a little bit of sacrifice.
And one thing I'd love to ask you about, because you finish off the book in the conclusions really powerfully, and you talk about the psychological power of hope. And, you know, in this day and age, as you write about, it's so easy to be cynical. It's so easy to feel like everything is against us. You know, you switch on the news and it's all bad news. But for someone listening to this to suddenly become hopeful, to feel like they can change their financial position, why did you, I guess, finish off talking about, you know, not being cynical and being hopeful? What was the reason for that, why you wanted to finish the book in that way?
I think I wrote that chapter for me, honestly, Because a lot of times we talk about money so we can stop talking about money. Because usually when we talk about money, it's the stress, it's the complaints, it's the, man, I'm so broke, joking around with friends. And I was that guy. I was cynical toward adulthood, and a lot of that stemmed from my money problems. And I think cynicism holds us back way more than we could ever know, not just in our money, but in our relationships. It holds us back from committing to people and things and jobs and careers, and it stops us. It's kind of just it's an easy way to say, hey, I've been burned. I don't want to get hurt again. That's what cynicism is. And so I think it's much more difficult to choose hope every single day. And it sounds cheesy to be like, choose hope. But all this is saying, I have agency over my life. I have autonomy over my decisions. And while there's not a whole lot I can control in this chaotic world, I can control that guy in the mirror. I can control how hard he works. I can control how he spends his money. And if you can just get control of that person, that will give you hope. Because you lose hope when you decide, not my problem, not my solution. Everyone else has to change. It's the government, it's the program, it's inflation, it's the housing market, it's my socioeconomic status. And while my parents really screwed me up because of how they handled money and, you know, their marriage. And at some point, you just got to go, listen, I got one life. And like, what am I going to do with that dash and that gravestone? Am I going to waste it, squander it, being cynical, blaming everyone else? Or am I going to do something with my life instead and overcome in spite of all the things holding me back? And those to me are the people that those are the videos we watch online and the movies that we watch, and they make us weep because of how powerful it is when people can overcome. And I think we were created by a creator to be overcomers, to have freedom, not to be enslaved to debt companies. And so that's why I ended the book with that. It was a little bit for me because I needed to hear it, and I was hoping that other people might need to hear it too.
Yeah, I think it's very, very much needed message. And I would love to kind of, I guess, just kind of shift gears and perhaps go from debt and perhaps let's get into, I guess, the mechanics really of building wealth. So I would love to know, what are perhaps some conclusions that we can be drawn from the Ramsey biggest study ever done on millionaires? What are some lessons that we can take away from that?
Well, kind of the funniest lesson to me was that the millionaires that we studied were very average investors. They were not super smart prodigies that chose the right funds. They were average at best. And what they did really well was just invest consistently over a long period of time. That was it. And most of them, 80%, said, hey, it was the 401k, it was the retirement plan through my employer that got me to millionaire status. It wasn't some, you know, luck of the draw or lottery, or I got into the single stock or some newfangled crypto. It was very boring, but that gives me so much encouragement, because if we can just follow a boring, consistent path, we can build wealth.
Right. So there's something in there that we need time and we need consistency, and we also need from that I'm taking away is that what people probably want to hear is that there's something exciting going on, that I stayed up all night and I researched for months and months and months and then I picked the winning stock. But what you're saying is that no, that's probably not the case. It's probably much less exciting, probably much more robotic than that.
Exactly. Well, one of the funniest studies was done was they found that people who had the most success in the stock market were dead people because they had not touched their investments and they were just sitting there invested. They weren't taking it out. They weren't moving it around. It was just sitting there growing. And so, you know, we talk about this in the book of all the investing traps that are out there. And I compare single stocks to betting on a single racehorse, and mutual funds, which is just a giant basket of stocks, to buying the entire racetrack. Well, now we got a chance of winning, because one of those horses has got to win. So that's what I love about mutual funds or index funds. This is a giant basket of stocks that we're betting on that have a proven track record. And so the U.S. stock market over time has produced about 10 to 12% an average annual return over, you know, the last many decades. And that's very encouraging because that 10, 12% compounds. So your money makes money. If you invest $10,000 and it turns into 50, well, now you're making 10 or 12% on the 50. And when it turns into 100, you're making 10 or 12% on the 100. And so as you get into the six-figure mark, that snowball of compound growth really starts to roll. And that's what causes people to become millionaires. That plus paid for primary home. And that's why we encourage people to buy a house and pay it off before they retire. And, you know, we recommend a 15-year mortgage. I know the loans are very different across the world, but we have the main ones are the 30-year and a 15-year fixed rate. Those are the most common. And with a 15-year mortgage, worst case, you pay it off in 15 years. And we find on average, millionaires pay off their homes in 10 years or less. People that follow the baby steps at Ramsey pay it off in 7 years on average. And what that allows them to do is free up their largest fixed expense, that mortgage payment, to now invest and to give and live their life. And it's so freeing to do that as early as possible. And that's why my wife and I did it in our early 30s, so we can have the next 30 with freedom and options.
So I wonder if perhaps you could quantify this for me. So let's say now that someone listening to this is 25 or maybe even 35, or perhaps you're a parent and you've just got a young kid. And let's say that you have a spare £100 or $100 going spare per month. What kind of returns could you look at if you were just willing just to set up something like you described, a 10 to 12% return, and robotically, without even thinking about it, it comes out of your account every month into one of these. What kind of returns perhaps could someone be looking at for what is quite a simple and, I guess, just robotic investing approach? What would that look like?
Yeah, let me pop it into the calculator for you. So let's say you start with zero. I think that's many people out there like, hey, I've never invested. And let's say you just put that money away into a proven investment like a mutual fund or an index fund that's kind of covering the entirety of the stock market. And you said $100 a month?
Yeah, $100
a month. £100? Okay, so that would be $1,200 a year. So that's not much. You think, okay, $1,200 a year. So let's say you're going to give it 10 years to grow. You keep doing that $1,200 a year for 10 years and you get a 10% return on average. Now, remember, the market is not a straight line. It's a roller coaster. And so some years it's going to be down, some years it's going to be up. But over the course of time, if you looked at the whole thing, you might see 10%. And so I'm going to do the calculation for you. You would have $20,000 after 10 years. And remember, you did $1,200 for 10 years. So that's 12,000 you put in. Now you have over 19,000. But let's see what happens when you let it sit for 20 years. So again, you've now invested what, 24,000? Well, that's turned into 68,000. That's pretty cool. And then what if you gave it 30 years to grow? Because then you've put in 36,000. It's turned into 200,000. So you put in 36, it's spitting back out now at 200. And now 40 years, let's say you're 25, you start doing this now, $100 a month. That's going out money. That's bar money right there, $100 a month. For 40 years, you let that grow, you'll have over a half million, 531,000 after 40 years of doing $1,200. And again, that's 48,000 you put in, and it's now 531,000 in the account balance. So that's encouraging because what happens, Joe, you start doing some bigger math. You go, what if I could invest $1,000 a month into my retirement plan? Well, that's $12,000 a year for 40 years. That's $5.3 million. Now the numbers change. It gets very exciting. And the problem is people glorify debt. And I'm telling you, they have $1,000 in payments between their car and their mortgage and the student loans and the credit cards and the personal loan. So when you can free up that debt payment and instead invest it for the future instead of paying for the past, amazing things happen. Interest that you pay is a penalty. The interest that you earn is a reward. And the baby steps, what they're trying to do is get you away from the penalty and get you toward the reward as fast as possible.
Wow, those numbers are just staggering. And it does go. And the thing that I like about it, and I'm not criticizing, investments, things like crypto, for instance, they are what they are. They're high risk, of course, assets. Take it as it is. But to me, clearly, it seems like that cannot be route one. That cannot be the, as we would say, the bread and butter of your investing approach, you know. So what other, investment mistakes or, wealth building traps people falling into? Because what you just described there, to me, it just sounds like a no-brainer. It just sounds like a very simple thing. Have your money go into it, and, you know, pretend that you're dead and
That's the mentality. Pretend that you're dead and just leave your investments alone. Stop messing with it. Stop looking at it.
Or maybe even die, as you said, and keep
that's
the
one strategy.
But yeah, but so what would be some perhaps other, I guess, wealth building traps that perhaps people may fall into?
In the Investing Traps chapter of Breaking Free from Broke, I talk about the three stooges of wealth building. And at the root of each trap, I found there's one of three emotions and character traits happening. It's fear, pride, or greed. So fear will drive you to make some really stupid decisions. It will drive you in scary economic times to go out and buy all the gold you can, because if it all goes down, I guess you'll be bartering gold for food and water and ammo. Who knows? And then pride says, well, I'm smarter than that. I'm going to pick the right single stock. I'm going to pick the right crypto coin, and I know what I'm doing. I'm going to go day trade, or I'm going to sports bet. And then greed has a lot to do with these newfangled traps, even crypto, that say, I need to make a lot of money really fast. I need to 10x my money in the next year. Well, that's where greed sets in, where you want way more than should be humanly okay and possible. And all of those can cause you to stumble and fall. So for as far as overall investing mistakes people make, it's they're either not investing at all, they're trying to invest while they're in debt and they're split a thousand ways, they're investing in the wrong things, like a lot of those traps that I talk about, instead of time-proven assets. And lastly, they just haven't had the education. And so getting equipped with the right knowledge, and that's what I tried to do with this book, was write a book that anyone, whether they're 16 or 66, could understand and go, I know exactly what I need to do. I've never understood these concepts. Thank you for breaking it down in a simple way. Once you have the education, the knowledge, the right path, and you're avoiding all the traps, you're investing consistently, I believe anyone can still build wealth in America today and across the world. And we're getting more and more questions and DMs from people because they're realizing our plan, while the semantics might be different of what retirement account, the basics are there. Live on less than you make, get out of debt and stay out of debt, have an emergency fund of 3 to 6 months, invest for the future at a higher rate than you're probably doing now, and get your mortgage paid off so that you have as few payments as possible in your life. That is the best way to live the way you want, to invest the way you want, and to give the way you want.
And I'd be curious to get perhaps your thoughts on, what perhaps some people might call, I guess, exponential wealth. And because, of course, what we talked about today was, for instance, like cut in debt. So we've talked about today about like cut in debt, using your wealth building tool, which is your income, to invest, to pay off debt, etc. But one perhaps argument that people can make is that essentially there is no, there's a limit to how much I can cut. There's a limit to how many, to how frugal I can be. And of course, that is dependent upon my income. If I was to ask you, for instance, what do you see as perhaps some of, I guess, the best wealth building, I guess, professions, businesses, side hustles, or perhaps methodologies that you see that perhaps could really, I guess, take us to that next level? Because, of course, we also want to have a higher income. That is, I suppose, the other side of the equation.
Absolutely. Well, there's kind of an interesting one that people don't think about, but marriage is kind of a wealth building hack when you think about it. When you find a spouse that's aligned with the same money values, the same goals, running the same direction, and is working outside the home, well, now you've got a money-making scheme here because you just doubled, potentially tripled your income. And so the things you're able to do when you have someone else's income involved is amazing. And that's part of the reason my wife and I were able to build wealth quickly, because we had dual income and no kids at the time. And now we've got a six-month-old girl, which truthfully, kids won't slow you down that much. Thank you. But, you know, people, there is an argument to be made that your best time to build wealth is when you're young, maybe single, maybe young married couple, both of you working. Because when you can create a six-figure income and you have no debt, it's amazing what you can accomplish. And so getting to that six-figure mark is a goal that a lot of people have. And it can be hard to do depending on your area, your expertise, your education level. But what I love is that no one is limited to where they are today. So if you're out there, you're making, you know, I don't know, $30,000, 30,000 pounds, it's not like you're stuck there. And a lot of people just think, well, I'm just a guy who makes 30,000 pounds. That's all I'm ever going to be able to do. And I'm going, no, I doubled my income just with side hustles. I was doing marketing, consulting. I was doing rideshare, driving, anything I could do. I was building websites for entrepreneurs and authors and speakers. All of that can help double your income on nights and weekends. And so think about the skills you have, the time you have available, and what your target is. When you have a strong why of why you're trying to make this money, it's way more powerful than just trying to make money for the sake of making more money, thinking it will solve your problems. And when you do make that money, you've got to budget it. You've got to put it on paper with a plan of where that money's going to go. Otherwise, you just increase your lifestyle and it becomes more spending money that disappears instead of working for your goals and your future. And so there's a both and. The way to make margin, to build wealth or get out of debt, whatever you want to do, is to spend less and make more. So after you've cut everything you can cut out of that budget, you've gotten really frugal, you also have to go, how can we add to our income every month in order to get to where we want to go?
Of course, on the Ramsey Show, not only do you guys get, I guess, unfortunately, very poor people, but you also do get a lot of very rich people. What are the main kind of careers or professions that you typically see from these people, the uber wealthy?
You know, we have a lot of people that call in or they do their debt-free scream on the stage, and we always ask them, hey, what do you guys do for a living? And many of them now make six figures. They may not have started there on their journey, but a lot of them are in tech, they're in sales. We've seen on our millionaire study, the top three careers were engineer in number one, attorney number two, and teacher. Or sorry, accountant instead of attorney. Attorney was further down the list. So engineers, accountants, and teachers made up the top three careers. And these are very attainable careers. These are not like celebrities, athletes, doctors. Doctors didn't even make the top 10. And so what that tells me is it's not about your career and the income you make. It's about having a process and a consistency and a path. And so teachers, they're not trying to impress people. They're trying to survive the day with these crazy kids. Accountants, they're always counting the money. And so they're going, hey, where's this dollar going? Where's this dollar going? And then you look at engineers, they're very process driven. And so when we see those careers as well as tech and sales, you know, look at how marketable your degree is going to be. So don't just get a political science degree or sociology degree without understanding what realistically what jobs are on the other side and what those jobs realistically pay for entry level folks. And that will help you understand the path to upward mobility. And also, you might switch careers. Many people don't end up using their degrees, and that's okay. Don't feel like you're stuck just because this is the degree I have. Look at what skills are lying underneath that for what you want to do.
So I'd love to just kind of ask you just a couple of questions. I guess when I was speaking to people, because we always love to pour out to our audience, our Instagram audience, I love to always ask friends and people close to me and kind of get the feeling about what people are interested in really this topic. And I'd just love to kind of pitch two things to you that I think you've thought a lot about one. I haven't heard you speak too much about the other, but I'll just go in order. So in terms of the first one, I imagine, you know, a common pushback that you get on the Ramsey Show, of course, is about credit cards. Now, when people say to you, you know, oh, I can get a load of air flyer points, or it's safer for me to use a credit card to book a flight or this or that. What is a kind of a common retort that you give to those arguments?
Well, I very rarely win because people are so convinced of their own experience that they can't see beyond that. They can't see an alternative future. And all I deal with all day long on the Ramsey Show is the scenarios where they never thought it would happen. They never thought they'd have a balance. They never thought that emergency would hit. And the other piece of this is you're spending more. And so every study shows that you spend more when you swipe that credit card, because when it's someone else's money, you psychologically treat it differently. So when anyone, they always say this, I've never paid a dime in interest. I treat it just like cash. I treat it just like my debit card. And I go, bull crap. If that was your money coming out of your bank, you would think twice about that purchase. And so psychologically, it's different because when it hurts less, it costs more. And it hurts less when you just swipe a card and then walk away with your stuff. When you have to hand over a bunch of dollar bills, man, that is painful. And so it changes the physiology as far as spending goes. And we also now know where these rewards are coming from. It's disgusting. The Federal Reserve did a study here in the U.S. They found that $15 billion moves from the poor, uneducated to the wealthier, educated through rewards. And that really was disgusting to look at from just a moral, sociological perspective. And then on top of that, the way the credit card companies run experiments on consumers is so gross. I interviewed an ex-Capital One manager who told me they run 10,000 experiments. Like, you're a rat in the maze. They're constantly changing the rewards and the values. And instead of cash back, let's change it to points, because people don't know what 100,000 points is. They just feel good. They don't know what 100,000 airline miles is. It's not air miles. That gets converted into one flight, you know, halfway across the country. And so people need to really be thinking about what they're really spending to get those menial rewards. And we have found that when you do a budget and you use your own money, you're basically rewarding yourself without putting yourself at risk. And it's impossible to go into debt using your own money. The money will run out. And that is a stopgap that I think is wise for all humans.
Yeah, man, that's really wise. And I'd love to just ask you perhaps one more question before I get to sign off. Tell these guys where they can connect with you. And this was another audience question that we had. I'm a little unsure in terms of like specifically what was meant by this, but the comment was that some social experiences, for instance, are really dependent upon age. For instance, this is the way I'm taking it, but if I go to, I'll just say Ibiza, and I want to go partying in Ibiza when I'm 20 or 25 or maybe even 30, that's considered normal. But comparatively, if I avoid those experiences when I'm young and I save up my money, and eventually when I do have money, then I go and do those things, then I really can't go to Ibiza when I'm 50 or 60 years old. You know, I can't really go and stay in a hostel in Buenos Aires, you know, or go interrailing through Europe and stay in these hostels. Do you think that, you know, people may think that it's creepy. Do you see any logic in the age-dependent argument, or do you have another kind of take on that?
Well, there's definitely this YOLO mentality and FOMO. So there's a fear of missing out. There's the only live once. And that crowd is generally trying to justify poor financial decisions under the guise of, well, I got to live my life, man, while I'm young, because one day I won't be able to do that. And what they're not seeing is, on the other side of that trip, they're going to pay for 6 months to try to pay that off. And there's going to be stress on the other side. And psychologically, they're going to feel a little bit of that weight while they're on that trip, that, man, this is going to add a weight later on. And so what we found is, if you can sacrifice for those 2 years to get out of debt and budget, you can go live your life when you're 25 instead of 22. But in our minds, we lie to ourselves and say, well, it's either this or when I'm 60, Joe, so I got to do it now. Instead of going, no, you can budget for 6 months and save up and pay cash for that trip and still go. So the point of the baby steps is not to strip you of all joy. It's to cause you to create a level of discipline and sacrifice so that you can have exponential joy on the other side. But most people end up living in mediocrity and stress for 20 or 30 years because they're not willing to sacrifice for two or three.
Sure, sure. And George, this has been a great privilege for me. I got to say, it's always a pleasure for me when I listen to someone a lot, and then I always get a chat with them. Man, the question we ask at the end of all of our show, before I ask you to sign off and tell these guys where they can connect with you, is for George Camel today: what makes your life worth living?
Oh, well, you caught me at a good time, because I just had we just had a little girl 6 months ago. And I got to tell you, as a guy who was, you know, I was getting kind of, you know, a little bit burnt out and cynical towards everything going on. We're heading into an election year. Work's been crazy with the book launch. And then we brought this little girl into the world. And there is something that changes your physiology when you look into your daughter's eyes and you can get her to smile. You're like, there's still joy in the world. Oh, good. I just need to change my inputs. And I've been focusing on the wrong things. I've been staring at my phone, looking at headlines. So I think that's what's making life worth living now. There's something that changes my financial decisions. It changes kind of where my goals are at when you have a little kid in your life. And now you're thinking about legacy. Now you're thinking about, what can I do to make that kid's world better, instead of looking inward focused about, what about me? And so there's a beautiful selflessness that comes with starting a family. And it's one of the reasons I recommend it, because getting outside of your own head and outside of your own selfishness, I think, is part of the human experience. And having a kid is a wonderful way to do that.
Amazing. Man, where can these guys connect with you? What would you like to tell them about the book, where they can pick it up, and everything else in between you'd love to share?
Absolutely. Well, the book is available on Amazon across the world. You can also get it at RamseySolutions.com if you're stateside. And that would be pick up the book, Breaking Free from Broke, and get it to your friends to tell them, I believe in your financial journey. I want to give them a piece of hope. And it's a really fun read. So if you like audiobooks, we did a really cool audiobook with sound design, and I wrote music for it, and I read the book myself. So if you prefer audiobooks, that's a great way to do that. And then, of course, reach out to me on Instagram or X or Facebook at George Kamel, K-A-M-E-L. I would be honored to hear from your listeners.
Amazing. Well, we will link everything below. And it's always, I've been very much looking forward to this. And I knew when we turned up in matching shirts that this would be a great podcast.
I'm honored. You're like my better looking older brother I never had, Joe. Thank you.
And we will get this out. George, thank you so much, sir. What a pleasure. Let me hit the stop recording button.